Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'm reading for you today in digest format, World Radio Magazine Online for the month of April 2010. World Radio is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage and the Amp System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any of the use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. We have a fine website at www.handyham.org. Let's begin today with World Radio Online Newsfront. The FCC team assesses Haiti communications, praises radio amateurs. A Federal Communications Commission-led assessment team traveled to Haiti to evaluate the status of the country's communications infrastructure following the earthquake that struck January 12. Deployed in coordination with the United States Agency for International Development, the group came in response to a request from the Director General of Haiti's CONATEL, the National Telecommunications Regulatory Agency. The FCC team was led by International Bureau Chief Mindel de la Torre, who recognized efforts by radio amateurs. Writing on the FCC blog, de la Torre said the amateur radio community in Haiti, the Dominican Republic and elsewhere, has dedicated equipment and spectrum resources to the relief efforts. That was filed by the FCC through Amateur Radio Newsline. NASA to launch three new CubeSats in November. Three small research satellites with amateur radio education payloads are scheduled for launch in late November. Called CubeSats because of their shape, they come from Montana State University, the University of Colorado, and Kentucky Space as part of NASA's educational launch of NATO satellite mission. Kentucky's KSAT-1 is believed to be the first CubeSat to carry a 2-meter to 70-centimeter FM transponder, truly a cross-band repeater in space, and one that should be accessible by most amateur radio operators within its flight path, authorities said. CubeSats are in a class of small research spacecraft called PICO satellites. They have a volume of about 1 quart and weigh no more than 2.2 pounds. The University of Florida was selected as an alternate in case one of the three primary spacecraft cannot fly. That was filed by NSA through Southgate and a few other sources. Well, here we have that revised Element 2 technician question pool that's being released by the NCVEC. A revision to the new Element 2 technician class testing question pool has been released after a committee of the National Conference of Volunteer Examiner Coordinators found and corrected more than 50 typographical errors and clarified questions and answers to make them easier to understand. Changes are now incorporated in a revised Element 2 question pool that contains some 400 questions. 35 are selected to make up any given Element 2 exam. And in a departure from past Element 2 question pools, this one contains graphics and diagrams. The errata list, as well as the revised technician question pool, is available at the following website, http://www.ncvec.org. This new Element 2 question pool becomes effective technician class examinations administered on or after July 1 and will remain valid until June 30 of the year 2014. Top band dinner plan this month in Visalia, California. The top band dinner, recognizing operations on the 1.8 megahertz 160 meter band, will be Friday, April 16, in conjunction with the 2010 Visalia DX Convention at the Convention Hotel, Visalia Holiday Inn in Visalia, California. The buffet-style dinner's guest speaker will be Bruce Butler, called W6OSP, whose program will be The Low Bands from K4M Midway. That's Midway Island in the Pacific. For our reservations, you can email to the following, WB6RSE1@mac.com. Thanks to Amateur Radio Noodles Line for that one. Our next news front piece, UK, United Kingdom, RadCom columnist Norman Fitch called G3FPK a silent key. He has passed away. Radio Communications Magazine, VHF / UHF columnist Norman Fitch, G3FPK, described as, quoting, having been a keen operator on the VHF, UHF, and microwave bands, and had been writing for over 20 years, close quote, has died. The Southgate News reports that Mr. Fitch was found deceased at his home in Surrey, England, on Friday, January 29. G3FPK took over RADCOM VHF UHF duties from Ken Willis, G8VR, in April 1989 when it was part of the Spectrum Analysis feature of the magazine. That silent key announcement was published by GB2RS. 160 meters okayed for Spanish radio amateur use in some contests. At the request of the Spain's National Amateur Radio Society, the Spanish Director General of Telecommunications has permitted use of 160 meters in certain contests. Several contest periods through the end of the year will now permit Spanish radio amateurs to use 1.810 through 2.000 megahertz. A complete listing is online at the Union Radio Aficionado Español's website, www.ure.es. CQ Contest Hall of Fame inductees to be announced at Dayton Dinner. The 2010 inductees to the CQ Contest Hall of Fame will be announced at the 18th Annual Dayton Contest Dinner, Saturday, May 15, at the Van Cleve Ballroom of the Crown Plaza Hotel in downtown Dayton, Ohio. CQ Amateur Radio Magazine contest editor John Durr, K1AR, will be Master of Ceremonies. He'll be joined by CQ Worldwide Contest Director Bob Cox, K3EST, who will announce the new inductees. Tickets are available online only, so if you're interested, go to www.contestdinner.com. Contest Dinner, one word, www.contestdinner.com. That was filed by K3LR. And here's a final little piece for some of you DX chasers. News from the DX scene. Here's some upcoming activity to look out for in the chase for DX. Folks, DX is chasing stations outside of the continental United States, anywhere else in the world. The call OH5SB, operating maritime mobile from the Baltic, will be on 2-meter single sideband this summer. The frequencies 144.288 or 144.300 megahertz. The call 7Q7HB is expected to be on this month from Malawi Digital and CW. The radio call EI6DX will be active portable 6W from Senegal. 6W is the prefix for Senegal in November. Lower bands and CW. Any updates for that? Well, you can go to www.ei6dx.com. We thank DX News Service for that information. It's time now for the editor's log. The editor for World Radio Online is Richard Fisher, KI6SN. It's titled At a Crossroad. It hardly seems possible, but it really was. 17 years ago this column, I was introducing myself as the new QRP, or low power columnist for World Radio Magazine. A lot of dits and dashes have crossed through the ionosphere since then. And today we find ourselves at another benchmark in the history of this fine magazine. Nancy Cott called WC8C, who for the past 8 years has so admirably served at the editor's desk, has stepped down. In the story of World Radio, she will be known as the first-rate journalist and as the captain who so masterfully steered us through a transition from print to online. As a successor, I'm deeply indebted to WCHC and to the editors who so nobly served before her in World Radio's 39 years. Stephen Swartz, W4ARZ, from Capon Ridge, West Virginia, writes what surely are the sentiments of lots of World Radio online visitors. Quoting, "As a longtime reader, I think the online magazine is better than in its paper form," he said. "The color is a welcome change from the old black and white pages. The copy and writing styles are right on. Very polished product." Close quote. Thank Nancy, a great writing staff, and a superb production team at CQ Communications Incorporated for that. Their fingerprints are all over the WRO, that ARZ, and so many others have appreciated monthly since February 2009. Indeed, WCHC's impact and contributions are indelible. We wish her well. Now, as we come to this latest WRO crossword, if you'd like a snapshot of the new editor, take a look at a copy of that introductory QRP column from April 1993. You'll find it posted on the New World Radio Online blog. It's at www.worldradioonline.blogspot.com. The KI6SN of 2010 is pretty much the same as 17 years ago, only more curious than ever about the magic of amateur radio and with a deeper appreciation of this magazine and its readership. By the way, the blog is just one of several new internet entry points WRO readers are invited to use, featuring enhanced, frequently updated content as a bonus to the monthly magazine. We hope you'll add them to your bookmarks. Now, the editor goes on to comment to several new features. The first one, WRO. Remember, that's World Radio Online. Live chat every month. At the World Radio Online blog, make note of WRO's new monthly live internet chat between the magazine staff and you, the reader. We're making http://www.worldradioonline.blogspot.com its home. Radio amateurs from across North America and around the world are invited to take part. I'll be moderating and conversing with you during that first session, Sunday, April 4 at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Here's how it will work. When the chat is live, type your question, comment, or suggestion in the Cover It Live box on the blog and submit it. It will appear in a chat box for everyone to see. I'll respond. It's real-time conversation. You'll be able to see and comment on others' postings, too. Along with the chat, we'll be conducting live readership polls during our monthly gab session. This is an opportunity to sound off to the editor, columnist, or other WRO readers. I hope to see you there. If you'd like a reminder in advance of the April 4 inaugural session, visit the blog, type your email address into the Cover It Live box, and you'll automatically get a note prior to the session. The next new feature, follow WRO on Twitter. To bring you updates in the ever-changing world of amateur radio, WRO is now on Twitter. The website there is www.twitter.com/WRO magazine. We hope you'll follow us and check in several times a day for breaking news of interest to the radio amateur community, as well as links to videos and websites. The next new feature, WRO on Facebook. WRO is now on Facebook. That's www.facebook.com. To find us, simply log into your Facebook account, type World Radio Online in the search box, and you'll see our direct link. We hope you'll stop in often and take part in the dialogue. And the last new item at the moment, WRO email address. In addition to all of this, we invite you to email us directly at this new address. It's one long word, worldradioonline at gmail, That's gmail.com. Please keep in touch. We look forward to hearing from and about you. And it's signed, the new editor for World Radio, Richard Fisher, KI6SN, Kilo India 6, Sierra November. Well, it's time now to go to our first major piece. This is in the category of Mars, for you not familiar with that organization. It's not the planet. It's actually military affiliate radio system, Mars. The United States Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and Air Force combined effort in amateur radio communications. The title here is An MCOM Benchmark. We know about disasters. What about catastrophes? The author, Bill Sexton, amateur call N1IM, and his Mars call sign is AA89PC. Bill begins with a quotation from Merriam-Webster's dictionary. A momentous, tragic event ranging from extreme misfortune to utter overthrow or ruin. Another, a violent and sudden change in a feature of the Earth, a violent, usually destructive natural event. And, of course, utter failure. I'm starting to write this column during the early hours of Haiti's suffering. Warning, some of the content may be disturbing to some readers. While I was working at my laptop, a muted TV across the room relayed scenes of carnage such as never aired before on the networks. Look up carnage, the word is used literally here. And where an unflappable Cronkite, or rather, once upon a time would have handled voiceover, this day's fervent reporting is coming from Twitter and YouTube. A cell phone camera in a tourist's hands informs the world. Already I'm concluding this is more than just another instance of nature's wrath. Unfolding on America's doorstep, projected into our homes in tormenting detail, it's no less than a compelling benchmark for measuring our own capacity to cope. Who could ever forget this tragedy? 2 months must pass before these mid-January musings will be read in the April issue of World Radio Online. That's a typical lead time to produce this sort of magazine. Haiti's plight won't have been forgotten in that time, but it's a sure bet any lessons learned in Port-au-Prince will be far out of most people's minds come the middle of March. One fresh crisis after another will have captured people's attention in turn. Let's face it, serious preparation for disaster is always able to be postponed, especially spending money on it, and it's no fun to think about anyway. We can, and we do, forget. The consternation of 9/11 isn't exactly forgotten 8 years on, but this country has yet to seriously address shoreline and port protection, chemical plant security, power transmission redundancy, and preservation of the Internet's integrity. And yes, we frequently talk about Hurricane Katrina. Yet the mounting fragility of levees on so many river systems, the folly of undiminished construction in coastal lowlands, the vulnerability of aging highways and bridges, and gross inadequacy of the railroad network always remain on next year's agenda, or the next administration's, like rebuilding New Orleans. Think the thought, if you're ever in a quake. On the TV, I see a collapsed school ringed by anguished parents, a few people struggling to move heavy chunks of concrete. It brings to mind a true story. Parishioners at a Tokyo church some years ago met with a seismologist for a discussion on how to react during Japan's frequent earthquakes. At the end of the meeting, the expert asked each person in turn to relate what his or her first action would be when a serious tremblor happened. Get outside into the open fast, said one. Make sure the gas is turned off, said another. Check on my elderly mother, fill the bathtub with water, and get flashlights ready, and so on. You are all such optimists, the expert told him. Has it never occurred to you, he asked, that you might be gravely injured, that the building may have fallen on top of you, that your family has perished around you. You seem to assume that only other people will be harmed. Think about it. A good point to bring up when appropriations are being discussed for the rest now. I'm wondering what possible lessons Americans might learn from Haiti. One surely is that rescue forces have to be capable of arriving much more quickly if appreciable numbers of lives are to be saved. For a major conurbation, we're talking hundreds of extraction teams to probe the tumbled wreckage. Massive resources on the same scale could be required in a cataclysmic terrorist attack or flood. And now that smartphones, YouTube, etc., have become the fastest source of situational awareness, FEMA and R-North, that's the Army Command responsible for domestic civil support, have better developed a mechanism to connect the millions of dots from Twitters and YouTubers into a coherent picture of ground truth when the next big U.S. emergency comes along, especially if the catastrophe is a terrorist nuclear adventure or a massive coordinated attack on the Internet that shuts down the economy as well as homeland security. Pretty much lost in this day's heavy news, Google and 30 or so other corporations have had their computer systems penetrated recently by suspected Chinese agents. What Haiti says to hams, for the amateur community in general, but Mars in particular, it's pretty much the same old lessons. The organization ARIS and RACIS are terribly diffuse above the state level. Training and effectiveness vary widely. Consolidation of resources is essential if we're to be really useful in catastrophe-level operations. As for Mars, after all these years, there's still no central operational doctrine allowing Army, Air Force, and Navy Marine Corps, Mars, to respond instantly under joint command, as common sense and the National Incident Management System demands. Despite the Defense Department being urged to provide for unity of command, its latest renewal of the charter under which the three services operate, and the reference here is the Department of Defense Instruction 4650.02, which was issued just December 23, 2009, neatly sidesteps that all-surpassing issue. The buck is passed to three separate assistant secretaries of defense who probably will find no more time for resolving the issue than successive chiefs of Mars operations have. Not exactly a model for unity of command from the Pentagon, by the way. Nor have we adequately planned for sending pre-organized response teams from safe areas into the obvious targets of man-made or natural calamities. Long overdue, these are trained, equipped, and ready to move in minutes. Still, there is good news for Mars. As this is being written, new software for emergency communications is about to graduate from beta testing. It enables Mars members to bridge a break in the Internet using VHF and HF radio for urgent official email, military and civil. The WinLink 2000 protocol is not new. But the WinMore client software, to apply it without expensive auxiliary equipment, represents a big breakthrough. A fresh event on the TV catches my eye. Troops of the 82nd Airborne Division are arriving to clear city streets so that incoming supplies of food and water can reach survivors. I recall the Indian Ocean tsunami on the day after Christmas 2004, in which around 230,000 persons died. U.S. Navy was fast on the spot there, memorably so. For all the differences of scale and casualty and geography, desperate events like the 2004 tsunami and Haiti earthquake and Katrina and 9/11 and the Mumbai attack 2 years ago, all have one element in common. Each hits us like a jolt of electricity as if we hadn't been warned over and over again to expect it or something like it. Not just predictable calamity, but also a mind-stretching, unimaginable kind. What about the perils we forget? Could a Haiti level calamity with thousands trapped, streets and freeways useless for rescuers' access, airport runways crumbled, seaport facilities wrecked, water and medicine exhausted, tens of thousands dying for lack of swift aid, could it happen in America? Please, friends, Google New Madrid Fault, in parentheses, the seismic zone that tracks the Mississippi River Valley from Memphis to Chicago, close parenthesis. Read how an upheaval there in 1811-1812 permanently shifted the Mississippi River's course. Church bells as far away as Boston were rung by the distant tremors. Between December 16, 1811, and March 15, 1812, remember, folks, we're talking 200 years here. It has been calculated more than 200 separate tremors occurred in this corridor, 15 of them between 6.7 and 7.7 magnitude. Parenthesis, January's in Haiti, magnitude 7. Close parenthesis. Some damage would have been caused over an area of 230,000 square miles, roughly equivalent to all of Texas. Fortunately, the West was barely settled then. No skyscrapers, no oil refineries, dams, or bridges yet. A few days ago, local emergency management officials in a populous and very strategically sited metropolitan zone gathered for a, quoting, catastrophic planning summit, close quote. The several hundred participants were presented with a truly staggering disaster scenario. They sorted into groups according to their specialties and set about trying to devise a comprehensive rescue blueprint for the 9 counties they represented. According to one who was there, the conference adjourned after a day and a half's work without even a start on a plan. He said the officials, many of whom had plenty of experience with real-life disasters, simply couldn't grasp the scale of response a true catastrophe would require. It was simply beyond their imagination. But that was before the wake-up call from Haiti. There's still time. The article is signed, Bill Sexton, N1IN-AlphaAlphaAlpha9PC. Well, after that somber piece, it's time to sort of change the tone here. Let's look at hamfests and special events. That's called going back to fun, I guess. For the month of April, California, 15th Annual Islands on the Air IOTA Dinner, Friday, April 16, Plaza Room of the Holiday Inn. That's on Airport Drive in Visalia, California. In conjunction with the 61st Annual Visalia International DX Convention, the IOTA dinner is open to all who are interested or active in the IOTA program. If you do not desire dinner, you may attend the IOTA program following the dinner. The doors open at 17:30. Information, you can contact Ray Benny, B-E-N-N-Y. Ray's call is N6VR. His telephone number, 928-848-2158. And now for the specific information about the 61st Annual International DX Convention. It's April 16, 17, and 18, sponsored by the Southern California DX Club at the Holiday Inn Hotel and Conference Center, Visalia. Top DXs from every continent, contest forum, antenna forum, DX forum seminars for everyone from the beginning DXers to seasoned pros. If you want more details, you can go to www.dxconvention.org/land. Now for the Rocky Mountains, Colorado, Longmont Amateur Radio Club Annual Swap Fest is Saturday, April 3 at the Boulder County Fairgrounds. They're planning to have lots of vendors, VE testing, talk-in on 147.270. Now in Florida, Venus Shark's Tooth Festival. April 9 through 11, 1300, 2400 Zulu, or until the bands close. Tamiami Amateur Radio Club, call K4S, special event call, Kilo 4 Sierra, Venus, Florida, various frequencies. State of New York, Orange County Amateur Radio Club, Hanfest is Saturday, April 10, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the town of Wallkill Community Center, to West Warren Drive in Middletown, New York, Premier Mid-Hudson Valley Hamfest. North Carolina, Raleigh Amateur Radio Society 38th Annual Hamfest, NCSARRL Convention, Sunday, April 3, 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. in the Expo Center Building, NCS Fairgrounds, Raleigh, huge electronic flea market. Also, they have a special event station N4C, November 4, Charlie, from this Hamfest on approximately 7.235 or 14.235. QSLing is possible. You can check it out on the websites. State of Texas Ham Expo, April 17, 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Bell County Expo Center. The address there is 301 West Loop 121 in Belton, Texas. It's sponsored by the Temple Amateur Radio Club. State of Washington, the 12th Annual Communications Academy, April 10 and 11 at South Seattle Community College, Pacific Northwest premier event for amateur radio operators, first responders, and others who want to expand and sharpen their emergency communication skills. There are going to be 30 workshops and seminars, including basics of setting up a station, exercise planning, managing an emergency team. MCOM organizations from around the Northwest and British Columbia will be there to demonstrate communications van. There are going to be vendor displays, door prizes, and a radio kit building contest. Now, as I move along with the reading of World Radio Online for April 2010, we'll go to promotion and recruitment. The title here is Creative Approaches to Introducing Students to Ham Radio. The author is Devere D. Logan, call W1HEO. Helping today's youth become the radio amateurs of tomorrow is easier said than done. Within the educational establishment, one of the barriers to including ham radio is that teachers are hard-pressed to cover the core academics. Student test scores are often the primary method of measuring teacher performance, so radio may be considered extraneous. To some teachers, however, integrating radio basics into science or physics lessons and laboratories is perfectly logical. In fact, ham radio can enhance the learning process. We've recently become acquainted with several instructors who have proven this. Their creative approaches that draw upon their ham radio knowledge have even motivated some students to become licensed operators. Richard Castanet, C-A-S-T-A-N-E-T, his call is WD4DMZ, teaches physics at Tucker High School in suburban Richmond, Virginia, a professional engineer. He uses ham radio to add interest for his 140 physics students. He reports that amateur radio was a mystery to them when first introduced to it, but that they were integrated. Quoting here, they have grown up in a world of cell phones, text messaging, and Facebook, etc., and it never occurred to them that there were methods of long-range communications before these things were invented, close quote. Castanet introduces his classes to electrical components, circuits, and radio physics to get them excited about the second semester course content. Having them build a breadboard QRP, that's a low-power transmitter, and trying their hand at sending code and hearing it come out of a transceiver really excites them. He reports, I've introduced Morse code to 140 students this year. Every student lab group has assembled a code practice oscillator, and every student has tapped out their name, legibly, to me in Morse. One challenge is finding the funds to buy kits and radio components used in his classes. School budgets are tight these days, so Castanet has gone outside to find financial support. The local power company's charitable foundation, for example, provided a grant that paid for kits and a solar power system. My hope is that most of the students will head into technical fields after graduation, and perhaps a few will be bitten by the ham radio bug, he said. Now here's the career link. Many ham educators feel that today we should sell ham radio as a means to an end. Careers in electronics are a prime example. Whether mainstreamed into classes or through after-school clubs, the career path can be a powerful incentive to both school administrators and parents. We have to sell ham radio to the school administrators, the principals, teachers, and then school boards, the PTA, and finally the population that fund the school, emphasizes Ken Mugley, call K0HL. As an enthusiastic advocate of involving ham radio in the schools, he developed a detailed PowerPoint presentation. It was titled Career Paths for Our Children. That explains amateur radio and its strong relationship to career development. And as an aside here, folks, if you're interested in that particularly, you can contact Ken at the following, dakclock at beu.midco.net. I'll say it quickly, dakclock, one word, at beu.midco.net. I know sometimes it's hard for you to pick up on that listening on the radio, folks, but that's the best we can do with some of this stuff. Ken recently discussed this with the president of his local school board. We'll be quoting here, if the school administrators see its value, then and only then will the program have even a remote chance of being successful, he emphasizes. Selling directly to the children is a waste of time, close quote. Well, folks, I guess that's telling it the way it is, huh? Now, as regards a family affair, a somewhat different view is held by the Lake Washington Ham Club of Kirkland, Washington. Their radio classes have produced 1,000 new hams focusing on ages 9 through 12. The secret? There must be a secret here. Both the student and one of his or her parents must attend the classes. The goal is to license both the student and the parent. The parent team member is needed to support the child in the purchase of a radio, to provide transportation, and to join any activities, explains teacher Dave Condon, call KI7YP. Classes are short, 40-minute lessons with built-in recess times between each lesson. The class is limited to 3 lessons per week. Donuts, juice, and coffee are provided. In 3 sessions of 3 hours each, children can earn radio licenses, with the final session being of the exam, he says. Once the children and the parents have earned their technician license and purchased handheld radios, the real learning about amateur radio begins. And the author concludes with the power of demonstration. One of the major opportunities to showcase ham radio to youth and parents is, of course, ARRL Field Day. That's the American Radio Relay League Field Day. Clubs that include public demonstrations receive extra bonus points in their score. The result of this motivator is a coast-to-coast flurry of activities starring amateur radio in action. Another popular event is the School Roundup, in which educators and students participate. The Gilmore Academy of Gates Mills, Ohio, was among the participants in last year's roundup, according to instructor Brother Ken Kane, KG8DN. Quoting here, our decision to set up the 20-meter sideband station in the student center during the week resulted in greater student interest, especially during lunch and on Friday afternoon, he said. We ended the week having secured 116 voice contacts with 10 clubs and stations in 22 states and 20 countries. Some radio clubs have sponsored ham radio demonstrations at public libraries and malls. For example, the Norwalk, Connecticut Amateur Radio Club showcased shortwave radio in cooperation with the Norwalk Public Library. The club installed a 40-meter inverted V antenna on the library roof and connected it to a shortwave receiver on the main level. They billed it as an opportunity to experience the thrill and adventure of amateur radio. Hands-on involvement and personal demonstrations have long been among the most effective ways of getting people involved in our hobby. Whether it's a personal demonstration with a family friend in a radio shack at your home station area, in a school, or a major showcase of ham radio in a public venue, seeing and hearing what today's ham radio is all about is a powerful promotional tool. What has your club done lately? Tell us about it. Your photos are welcome, too. In the meantime, check out the Ham Radio Promotion Project at www.neoham.org. That's Neo, N-E-I-O-H-A-M. So again, it's the Ham Radio Promotion Project at www.neoham.org. I'm going to take a few minutes today, folks, in this recording from the World Radio Online for April 2010 to feature 1010 International. The article here is titled In Profile, A Labor of Love for Jack Moore, K5CC. Jack's 1010 number is 50708. The author, Gerald F. Gross, WA6POZ. This month we profiled Jack Moore, K5CC, a 1010 International director living in Boulevard, Texas. In his own words, here's his story. My interest in amateur radio started from listening to stories from my great-uncle, Vert Elmer. He built a spark gap station in 1915 and received his license in 1916 as 9 Bravo Alpha. The government took his transmitter at the start of World War I. It was a long time before he got back on the air. After I got my license, I helped him get his in 1952 as W9BB. We worked each other on CW, that's Morse code, folks, until his death. He never got on phone, which is actually voice, folks. I have his old radio papers. I received my license in 1950 as a W9LZT in Illinois. I built a power supply for an ARC-5 aircraft transmitter on 40 meters. I used this for 6 years. Television interference was a big problem, as I would wipe out TV for several blocks around. Ain't that the truth? In 1956, my wife Barbara and I went to Germany for a tour that lasted 5 years. I obtained the German call DL4CP. I built Heathkit DX35 and Apache transmitters. The late 1950s were the best sunspot cycle on record. It was common to have 10 meters open 24 hours a day. In terms of getting on the air and making contacts, it was the most productive time of my amateur career. In 1961, we moved to Seattle, where I became K7QPT. I traveled a lot, so amateur radio was second fiddle to travel and family matters. I made a lot of Japanese contacts and got to visit several amateurs on my trips to Alaska. In 1964, we moved to Northern Virginia, where we spent an enjoyable 14 years. I had 3 calls during this period, WA4VXE, K4ASJ, and K4NF. I obtained my extra class license in 1968 by going to the FCC headquarters in Washington, D.C., and taking the written test and 20 words per minute CW exam. It was an intimidating experience. I worked Barry Goldwater several times on 2 meters in the Washington area. Many of you folks will remember Senator Barry Goldwater. For most of the time, I used a Swan 350 transceiver. Barbara and I earned our pilot's licenses and bought a Cessna 4-place airplane. I mounted 2 and 10-meter antennas on the plane and had a great deal of fun. While Barbara was doing the flying, I could play amateur radio. The 10-meter antenna wasn't all that efficient, but I made a number of contacts. 2 meters was fun, but I had to stay off repeaters since I brought up stations up and down the Northeast. We moved to San Antonio in 1978, looking to retire in the area. I retired in 78, and we moved to a house we built in the hill country on 22 acres. For the first time, I could put up decent antennas. I first became interested in 1010 after checking into the South Texas Light Horse Brigade chapter net. After checking into local nets for a year, I decided to ask members to come to a picnic at my place. This started a run that lasted 20 years. Over the years, members showed up from all over the country, Canada and England. I think everyone had a good time, and only age caused Barbara and me to call it quits. In 2001, I was asked to become trustee of W6OI, the 1010 International Club Station. This has been an enjoyable experience. In 2004, I became a member of the 1010 Board of Directors and will complete my service on the board at the end of 2010. For the first 4 years, I had responsibility for the 1010 internet activities and now have responsibility for the CUSO party program. I will complete 59 years in amateur radio later this year. I have enjoyed every year. This will be my sixth sunspot cycle, and I look forward to working as many members as I can. 1010 has been my main interest in amateur radio the past 20 years. It has been a labor of love. Continuing with 1010, it's going to be at Dayton and HamCom. 1010 will be at the Dayton Hamvention and HamCom again this year. Come say hello, sign the log, and see what's happening with 1010. At Dayton, we will be at booth 486 north of the ARRL area. At HamCom, we'll be situated with other amateur radio organizations. Now, regarding some upcoming 10-10 events. This year, the Spring CW Digital CUSO parties are being held on their own weekends. The 1010 Spring CW party will be held from 01 Zulu on April 24 through 2359 Zulu on April 25. As is the case with all 1010 CUSO parties, it is open to everyone. However, logs can only be submitted by paid 1010 members as of the date of the party. All of the logs received will be handled as check logs. 1010 members should exchange their call sign, 1010 number, name, and QTH, that's a state, province, or country. Stations without a 1010 number should use 000000. Five zeros. For non-1010 members, this is a good time to make those initial 10 contacts to qualify for membership while using the zero login as your 1010 number. CUSO party logs must be returned to the CUSO party manager within 14 days of the end of the party. Meanwhile, the open season contest will be held starting at 0 Zulu on June 5 through 2359 Zulu on June 6. This contest is to stimulate PSK activity on 10 meters and is hosted jointly by 1010 International, the Penn-Ohio DX Society 070 Club, and European PSK Club Digital Groups. It is not necessary to be a member of any group to participate. For more information on the other two groups, please visit their websites. Open season logs must be returned to the CUSO party manager and be postmarked not later than June 26. For complete dates, rules, and where to send logs for all 1010 events, visit the 1010 website. And here it's spelled out, www.ten-ten.org. Now, if you'd like a lot more information about 1010, the easiest way to obtain information is to visit the organization's website, www.ten-ten.org. If you have been issued a 1010 number and have forgotten it, send me an email and I will send it to you. A 1010 number is issued for life, regardless of the call or calls you may hold. I would also appreciate any comments or suggestions. Please send them to Jerry, spelled G-E-R-R-Y, Gross, G-R-O-S-S, call WA6POZ, number 21274. That's 21274, 1010 President. The street address, 16046, Orchard Circle, Omaha, Nebraska, N-E, 68135, or email lowercase WA6POZ at TEN-TEN.org. Folks, on page 48 of the World Radio Online for April 2010, there is a rather complete comprehensive listing of VE examination places and times. VE is Volunteer Examiner Examinations. As a service to our readers, World Radio Online presents a feature listing of those VE exams, times, and locations which are sent to us. Please remember that our deadline for publication is 2 months in advance. Now, as for an example, if your group is scheduling an exam for December, Please have the information to us by October 1st. World Radio Online, VE Exams, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. List a location, city, and state, any information examinee should have, like advanced registration information or whatever, and the name of the person to contact for further information. Examinees should bring their original license along with a photocopy, two forms of identifications, at least one should be a photo, and the required fee. Well, let's go now to MCOM and You. The article is titled, Advice Averted. Sometimes they just don't listen. The other air is Jerry Wellman, called W7SAR. Last summer, leaders from two different youth groups approached me to ask about communications for backcountry events involving several hundred kids aged 14 through 17. Their activities would take place in some very rural and mountainous terrain. They would be miles and hours from medical response. They wanted to be sure their activity would be covered by, quote, emergency communications. The group's activities, several weeks apart, would take them to an area I was pretty familiar with. I'd hiked and traveled the region and had set up communications for other groups participating in similar activities. When I met with last year's group's leaders, I had topographic maps, diagrams, equipment lists, and even a cache of radios on a commercial frequency license for such use to loan the groups. Over several hours, I answered questions and shared ideas as to how they might have good umbrella coverage where emergency communications was concerned. At one point, one of the leaders picked up one of my UHF portables. It's heavy, but not heavier than current technology and radios carried by police officers, for example. The fellow turned to me and said, "They wouldn't do. We're not going to carry those." I pointed out that not everyone carried a radio and that there should be one radio for each group of 10 people. He argued, pulling out a small cell phone, saying, "If it weighs more than this, we're not going to take it." The discussion went downhill from there. They didn't want to have to charge radios during a week-long event or buy alkaline batteries. They didn't want to set up a base station with a directional antenna. In short, setting up such a system would be too much bother. They declined. At that point, I was even wondering why they'd call to ask my opinion. I had been willing to loan them all they needed and even spend several weekends showing them how to set up stations. In the end, they were the experts and had no need for input they'd sought from me. They chose to go with their own ideas and a very simple plan. Use cell phones and just call each other. If they had a medical emergency, they'd dial 911. A few days after the meeting, an amateur radio operator who had attended with his two kids called and asked what ham repeaters covered the area they'd be in. "None," I answered. "How close was the nearest medical help?" "About 2 hours by helicopter in good weather," I answered. He and I talked about response time and that the sooner you called, the sooner help would begin responding. "Delay the call," I cautioned, "and you delay the arrival time." A few months later, I heard from one of the groups, the other group I had not talked with and presumed their experience may be similar. The leader reported they'd had no life-threatening emergency, but they did need to call about a possible allergic reaction. First of all, they discovered their cell phones did not work all the time. On many calls, they had to hike to high ground, and even then the coverage was intermittent. They could not call each other from where they were hiking and could not call to their base camp to report progress. The base camp was in a valley and had no coverage. It was good, he reported, that they did not need to call 911. Their cell phones drained many of the batteries in the first days. Then there were the usage charges. Because all of their phones were from different providers, there were different costs. For some, there were roaming and long-distance costs. The final tally was rather steep, costing much more than buying alkaline batteries for radios. For me, it was frustrating when one leader called to say, "We should have used your equipment and listened to your advice." While it was nice to receive his call, I took no satisfaction in being proven right. After all, I really had no dog in the fight. It was not an event I was participating in, and I wasn't funding the cell phone cost. I was happy they had no medical emergency. In 20 years of writing this column, my experience with the youth group leaders is similar to those you have shared as well. One reader said he was accused of crying wolf and being overly dramatic in responding to a request to help an agency plan for emergencies. Some readers have reported great success, and to be honest, I've heard a number of youth groups use my equipment on backcountry activities and report it worked very well. It's not that the advice you and I give is wrong. Often we propose a system that covers emergency needs. It's simply insurance for when things go wrong. If nothing went wrong, did it mean the advice was flawed? No. It means you were prepared and prudent in your planning. I've already fielded a couple of calls concerning the upcoming 7 months of youth activities. I don't advertise, and the calls have come from groups who have talked to other groups who over the years have advised. I'll again spend a few hours showing photos, discussing the need, and even pull out the maps and radios to demonstrate. My hope is they will not seek my advice and take my time, and then tell me I'm silly because my system doesn't depend on cell phones. A few moments after CNN began reporting a major earthquake in Haiti, my phone rang. Several local media folk, who also are friends, called to ask if I'd heard anything on my radio. I'd been tuning around 20 meters and did hear a maritime net relaying a tsunami warning, but nothing from Haiti. I'm not into DX, and my station antenna at work, where I was at the time, consists of a dipole atop a 10-story building. It's not the best, but allows me to hear nets from around the region to get my daily radio fix. The lesson here isn't that my radio system is inadequate and that I should be convincing my boss to let me put up a better antenna system. There were other operators with DX stations around the valley I referred the media to in their quest for information. The lesson is that even in these times of internet and cell phones, when a crisis hits, many will turn to amateur radio for initial reports. As I surfed the Associated Press reports, there were many dispatches with reference to amateur radio, which remains a viable resource and method for emergency contact. I sincerely doubt that will change in the near future. So the lesson is to be prepared and know that in the initial stages of an emergency, the expectation is that amateur radio is there. Until next month, best wishes from Salt Lake City. Jerry Wellman, W7SAR. Ladies and gentlemen, this brings us to the conclusion of the reading of World Radio Magazine Online for April 2010. World Radio is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Anti-Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Anti-Ham members only. Any abuse may violate copyright laws. Anti-Hams may reach at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website, www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My location, or QTH, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. Thanks a lot for listening along with me again here on the Courage Handyham System, 73.